Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 56, Classic Killers. Hi, I'm Jake. Nikki and I are taking the week off from recording so we can spend Thanksgiving weekend with our loved ones. Back in our anniversary episode, we talked about finding ways to take advantage of our back catalog. This week, instead of leaving you with no Hub History, I'm going to make my first attempt to recycle some old episodes. While we were preparing last week's show about the boy fiend Jesse Pomeroy, we were struck by the fact that it was our third episode about a serial killer in barely more than a year. Since last week's Thanksgiving episode was all about a horrifying serial killer, why not keep the holiday cheer going with a classic episode about two more of Boston's historical serial killers? We promise that next week's show about Boston's response to the 1917 Halifax explosion and the tradition behind the city's official Christmas tree will be a bit more uplifting. At least that one has a happy ending. Okay, first up is the story of Jane Topin, the Nightmare Nurse. This story originally aired as Episode 7 on December 11th, 2016.
Jane Topin is Boston's lesser-known serial killer. Now, she really gets overshadowed by the Boston Strangler, but I think the facts around Jane Topin are actually a lot more fascinating and really a lot more disturbing. But before we get too far along, I want to define what we're talking about here. Now, the FBI is pretty vague in defining serial murder as the unlawful killing of two or more victims by the same offenders in separate events.
That's not really how lay people use that term, though. I associate serial killers with some kind of common intent, a thread that connects the killings, and that distinguishes them from when a person kills multiple times, but just in different crimes, like I killed somebody in a bank robbery this week, and then I killed somebody in a home invasion next year.
Right, but it turns out, at least from my research, that serial murder isn't really a legal term. It's more of a pop culture term, though, you know, of course, the courts and criminal justice system recognize the phrase and the concept.
And it stems from a German word, right? Serienmord?
Yes. Per the Oxford English Dictionary, the term serial killer comes from a film review in the 1960s, which references a German expressionist film from 1931. So, I do have a broader definition, though. A person who murders three or more people, usually in service of abnormal psychological gratification, with the murders taking place over more than a month and including a significant break, which is often called a cooling-off period. So, full disclosure, this is not legal or scientific, it's Wikipedia. But I think it describes the general public's understanding of serial killing, with the abnormal psychological gratification being the common theme. And ultimately, this is a history podcast, so I really had to stop going down this psychology true crime rabbit hole. Jane Topin was a nurse who, from 1885 to 1901, preyed on the sick and elderly throughout the Boston area, using her access as a nurse to murder at least 31 victims, which is the number that she confessed to, including three at Mass General in 1889. Jane was born Honora Kelly to Irish immigrants in 1857. Her mother died of consumption when she was young, and her father was known as just a combination of drunk, eccentric, and total crackpot, which are their words, not mine. I've seen several references to him called Crackpot Kelly. Now, there's a rumor that he sewed his eyes shut while working as a tailor, and it isn't really documented, but that's the kind of character that we're talking about here. However,
crazy one.
But we can't really say to what extent this would have impacted her, because when she was six, her father dropped her and her sister off at the Boston Female Asylum, which was an orphanage for girls, and presumably she never had any contact with him after that. But it's certainly not an auspicious start to life, and in less than 2 years, she's placed as an indentured servant in the home of Mrs. Ann Topin in Lowell, Massachusetts. And though she's never formally adopted by the Topins, She takes on their surname and eventually becomes known as Jane. Now, Jane paled in comparison to her foster sister. Jane is overweight, she's emotionally troubled, and she's prone to extreme jealousy. But at the same time, she's a very promising student. And I found a Lowell Sun article in 1938 at the time of her death that stated that in her schoolwork, as in her profession in later years, she was one of the leaders of her class, brilliant and aggressive in all things. But despite academic promise, she's left at the altar at age 19, and with no other marriage prospects and not wanting to be a domestic servant for life, she begins training as a nurse at Cambridge Hospital in 1887.
I was really struck when you said that Jane was indentured to the Taupin family, because I picture indentured servitude as being something that happened much earlier in American history. But I guess it wasn't actually technically outlawed until the 13th Amendment after the Civil War. Anyway, during Jane's residency, she used her patients for experiments with morphine and atropine. She experimented with how the two could be used to bring a patient close to death, revive them, and repeat the cycle. Morphine causes breathing to slow and will put a patient into a coma, and then atropine would revive them, but ultimately lead to painful spasms and death when given as an overdose. She would spend a lot of time alone with those patients, making up symptoms, falsifying charts and records, and medicating them to drift in and out of consciousness, up to a state of delirium, and then back into a near-coma state. She later confessed that she derived a sexual thrill from patients being near death, coming back to life, and then dying again. She'd get into bed and lay with them and hold on to them while they died. There is one account from a patient, Amelia Finney, who survived Jane's care in 1887 and described how Taupin gave her a bitter-tasting drink, climbed into bed with her, and held her and kissed her face frantically. Amelia recalled it the next day, but thought it had been a dream. It wasn't until the time of Jane's trial that she realized that this incident had really happened.
It's worth noting that this is quite rare for female serial killers, who usually murder for wealth or some type of material gain, but not sexual motivations. However, her later accounts and the professional opinions of the psychologist who evaluated her are somewhat conflicting when it comes to her motivations, meaning that she may have lied to support a defense based on her mental state. But I do have an interesting quote from her. "When the climax of my mania passed, I realized what I had done. I have known that my patients were dying. Then my greatest thought was to resuscitate them. I have then worked over them, trying to bring them back to consciousness. I have sent for doctors and other nurses and tried my best to save them. Sometimes I have been successful, but many times the poison was too much. They were beyond recovery and they died."
Regardless of motive, at that time there was very little supervision or oversight in hospitals, and her activities continued unchecked. And you have to wonder how much she is the reason behind the supervision and oversight in hospitals today. But to the casual observer at the time, she probably seemed like a very dedicated nurse, very compassionate, spending so much time comforting her dying patients. In 1889, she was hired by Massachusetts General Hospital, where she was able to murder three more victims before she was fired for theft.
And this is where it takes a darker twist.
If you can even imagine something darker than this has been already.
It goes there. Now, despite having a reputation as being a good caregiver and a compassionate nurse, there are now suspicions that follow her, and mostly it's really around the theft that happens, but it prevents her from taking a position in another hospital. And so she begins working as a private nurse, catering to Boston's elite, and this is ultimately what allows her to transition to killing entire families. She also begins to kill outside of her patients. She kills landlords that she owes rent to, she kills a friend whose job she hopes to steal, and she eventually kills her foster sister in 1899. Now, she'd later say that this was the first time that she had killed out of hate. And this is not a flare-up of rage. It is completely premeditated. She invites her sister to visit her on the Cape. She takes her on a picnic to the beach and gives her a glass of mineral water with strychnine. The next day, her sister is too ill to get out of bed. And rather than nursing her back to health, Jane has killed her within 2 days. And she later confessed, "I held her in my arms and watched with delight as she gasped her life out." At the same time, her brother-in-law does thank her for caring for his wife so dutifully. And so you can see that she really is able to maintain this act. But in time, she gets reckless. In 1901, she moves in with elderly Alden Davis and his family on Cape Cod to take care of him after the death of his wife, who she herself had conveniently murdered. Her next victim in the Davis family is the youngest daughter, Genevieve, though Jane did start rumors that Genevieve committed suicide. Alden went next, and then the older daughter, Minnie, is ultimately killed with an enema of whiskey, water, and morphine. And while Minnie was dying, Jane comforted her 10-year-old son.
You're right. This got wicked dark.
So now she's out of work because she's killed the whole family. So she moves back to her hometown of Lowell and attempts to begin a relationship with her deceased foster sister's widow. To endear herself to him, she kills his sister. And she does this so that she can comfort him in his grief. And then she poisoned him so that she could nurse him back to health. Now, sensing that things are still not going her way, she even went so far as to poison herself to become more sympathetic. And she actually does almost die. But for whatever reason, the brother-in-law doesn't take the bait, and he sends her out of his house before it's too late.
Meanwhile, Minnie's father-in-law was suspicious at this rapid series of deaths and the fact that Jane had been in debt to the family. In fact, the first member of the family was killed when she went to see Jane about collecting payment. The father-in-law ordered a toxicology exam on the bodies, and the report found that they had been poisoned. On October 26, 1901, Jane was arrested for murder. By the time of her trial in 1902, she had confessed to 31 murders, although it is thought that there were as many as 100 victims. Given the state of hospital record-keeping at that time, we can never know the exact number.
Now, it's important to note that at this time, the turn of the 20th century, serial killers were not a class of criminal that people were really aware of outside of Jack the Ripper. And there was definitely no well-known precedent for a female serial killer. And so the judge and jury, I have to imagine, just assumed that any woman who would do things like this must be insane. And she's found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed for life in the Taunton Insane Hospital. The jury only deliberated for 27 minutes.
But irony caught up with her in the end, right?
Yes. Although she lived to the age of 81, she was convinced throughout much of her confinement that someone was trying to poison her.
That's a bit of poetic justice. But I want to know whatever happened to that fiancé that jilted her and presumably avoided becoming her first victim.
Well, interestingly enough, she mentions him in her writings later in life, saying, "I still laughed and was jolly, but I learned how to hate, too. And if I had been a married woman, I probably wouldn't have killed all those people. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind."
Next up, we have the story of a killer who called himself the Giggler, which we released in June. This truly is one of the forgotten tales of Boston, despite happening within living memory. It contains descriptions of acts of violence against children, so use your own judgment in deciding whether that's something you want to hear. I'll also take this opportunity to apologize for the audio quality in this clip.
This week's story also opens with a grim anniversary.
Friday marks the anniversary of a 911 call recorded in the wee hours of June 16th, 1969, that is still chilling to hear.
On the plane, our dear, at the corner of Washington and Union Street, in the construction site, there'll be a man down in the water, dead. The giggler.
It's a little bit muffled, but the 911 operator says, Boston Police. Then the caller says, My dear, at the corner of Washington and Neyland Street, in a construction site, there'll be a man down in the water, dead. The giggler. And then he starts laughing. Police went to the construction site, and they found the body of a man named Joe Breen. At the time, Washington and Neyland was near the heart of Boston's combat zone, an unofficial district in which strip clubs and porno theaters were tolerated and prostitution was common. Perhaps the setting convinced the Globe to publish an article by Jeremiah Murphy about Joe Breen's murder that reads like a hard-boiled detective novel.
The last time Joe Breen was seen alive was in the Novelty Bar, a rundown joint in the neon-lighted combat zone where some people drink beer directly out of the bottle because they have a hunch it's safer that way. Breen walked in the front door on Washington Street. A long raised bar was on the left, and a cigarette machine and shuffleboard game was on the right. Illuminated signs advertising Schlitz beer were on the walls. A three-piece band was playing in the back. It was dimly lit inside the Novelty Bar, and people talked easily in obscenities, and nobody really paid any attention. It's that type of joint. There were the inevitable three or four young sailors sitting around, and eight or nine women, mostly in their 30s, and a few of them were pretty. They chain-smoked, and their eyes kept moving, always watching whoever came through the door. Breen was 31 years old, single, and a four-year Marine Corps veteran. He lived on Robert Street in Brookline, and worked for the water department there. He had a few drinks at the bar with the two fellows who were with him, then he started playing shuffleboard. His opponent, whom he had never met before, was in his early 30s, average height, and pudgy, wearing old clothes. Breen's two friends went across the street to another bar, and he stayed in the Novelty and played shuffleboard with his pudgy new friend. After a while, the combat zone bars closed, and Breen's friends returned to the Novelty to meet him. He was gone, and they never saw him alive again. The friends shrugged, figuring Joe Breen had gone along home, and they went home too. But at 1:30 a.m., a telephone call was received at Boston Police Headquarters on Berkeley Street. Bill Barnes of Brookline was with Breen that night in the Novelty, and he gave police a description of the shuffleboard player. For a long time, Barnes and a plainclothes policeman waited, night after night, in the Novelty, but the man never showed. The police officer was assigned to other duties, but Barnes kept going back, sitting alone at the bar, the rock band banging away in the background, the women in the booth still looking, still smoking, and Barnes waited and waited. One night, the shuffleboard player came in, and Barnes knew it was him. He quietly got up and walked to a telephone, and he called the police. They came right away, but it was too late. The shuffleboard player had gone. Again. The mystery would go unsolved for 6 months, while the murderer walked the streets.
On December 26th, a 9-year-old boy named Kenneth Martin went missing in Boston. The third grader from St. Ambrose School was last seen near South Station, where he worked as a pin setter at the station's bowling alley. Police had no leads in locating him until January 6, 1970, when they got an anonymous call saying that the body could be located in a passageway under South Station. At the time, there was a labyrinth of tunnels and corridors under the station, as well as a number of businesses and offices. The police eventually found Martin's body on January 8th. It was in an unused tunnel under the station. He had been strangled with a piece of twine that had been wrapped around his neck several times and tied tightly. Then his body was left in a canvas sack. There was no evidence of sexual assault. Witnesses remembered seeing the boy in the company of a dark-haired, chubby young man. The descriptions matched a drifter named Kenneth Harrison. Harrison was 31 years old, an unemployed cook and cab driver who often slept in one of the unused offices along the corridors under South Station. Harrison had jumped a train to Providence, but four Boston detectives went south and had the good fortune to spot him standing on a street corner near the train station. They arrested him and brought him back to Boston for interrogation. He quickly admitted to Kenneth Martin's murder, saying that they had both been killing time in the South Station tunnels, chatting in an unused office. Harrison said that he had been drunk out of his skull when he suddenly felt an irresistible urge to kill. He said he had felt bad after waking up beside the body, but coldly waited over a week before calling in the location to the police and leaving town.
But what he said next stopped the detectives in their tracks. As long as I'm here, I might as well tell you about a few more. That overpowering urge to kill had taken hold of Harrison before. His killing spree began in May of 1967, just 3 years after the strangler's grip on the city had loosened. The first victim of the Giggler was 6-year-old Lucy Palmerin. She was on her way to a candy shop to get a treat when she had the misfortune of getting into a cab driven by Kenneth Harrison. Somewhere during the ride, the urge to kill struck Harrison. He pulled the cab to the side of the street on a bridge over Fort Point Channel and enticed Lucy out of the car with the offer of a piggyback ride. Instead of boosting her up onto his shoulders, he pivoted and threw her into the water below. Somehow nobody saw him do it, so when her body washed ashore 5 weeks later, her death was ruled a tragic accident. Fort Point Channel must have held some sort of fascination for Harrison, because it was the site of one of his other murders as well. In November of 1969, just a month before Kenneth Martin's death, Harrison was walking across Broadway Bridge over the channel. When he saw an elderly woman slip and fall on the ice, he helped her up and offered his arm as assistance in crossing the bridge. Unfortunately for 75-year-old Clover Parker, that urge to kill swept over him again as they were crossing. Harrison punched her up, as he said in his confession, took her cane away, and then pitched the petite woman over the rail and into the water below. Again, there were no witnesses, and again the case was ruled an accident. But Harrison wasn't done confessing yet. He also admitted to killing Joe Breen in that construction site in the combat zone. He confirmed that he and Breen had spent many hours together that night drinking and playing shuffleboard, but when the time came to part, the two argued over who would pay for whiskey and cab fare. They fought, and Harrison pushed Breen into a water-filled trench among the construction site. As an ex-Marine, Breen was able to put up more of a fight than the small children and old ladies Harrison usually preyed on, but Harrison was able to get the upper hand. Every time Breen came up for air in the muck-filled trench, Harrison would bash him in the head with a large rock, until Breen eventually stopped coming up. He died in the water, his skull bashed in. That's when Harrison made his call to the police, reporting the body and claiming his comic book villain-like name, the Giggler. The detectives had him record portions of what was said in that call so they could match it against the original recording.
Yeah, this is Sergeant Whalen, and Kenneth Harrison is now going to read from a piece of paper a statement onto this tape. The date is January the 7th, 1970, and the time is 3:55 p.m.
3:47.
All right. Just hold that in front of us.
My dear, there'll be a man down in the water, dead, at the construction site, the corner of Neyland and Washington Street. Ha 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 ha, the Giggler.
Believe it or not, Harrison still had more to say. He tried to claim credit for the January 1966 fire that destroyed the Paramount Hotel in the combat zone and killed 11 people, saying he did it for giggles. For whatever reason, he was never charged with this crime, though it would have brought his death toll to 15. Perhaps they didn't believe him, or perhaps they thought the evidence was insufficient. In each of the other murders, Harrison's confession contained details that were never made public, and his statements on the Paramount fire were certainly less clear-cut. In the end, Kenneth Harrison was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of Kenneth Martin and given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. He received 3 additional life sentences for the second-degree murders of his other victims, with the sentences to run concurrently. He was remanded to the Bridgewater State Mental Hospital for evaluation and treatment, where he remained for almost 20 years. In April of 1989, the state ruled that the combination of therapies he had received at Bridgewater had made him rational enough to serve out the balance of his sentence at Concord State Prison. On the eve of the transfer, the man who dubbed himself the Giggler took a lethal dose of his antidepressant Elavil and died on April 20th, 1989.
All right, folks, that is it.
We'll have links, pictures, and sources for both these stories in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/056. Join us next week for a happier topic as we discuss Boston's response to the Halifax explosion and the Christmas tree that Nova Scotia gives us each year as a token of thanks. In the meantime, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can visit our website at hubhistory.com to see all the ways to subscribe to our show. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.